This and other podcasts are available on the Gun Rights Radio Network, gunrightsradio.com. Podcasting freedom.
I'm hiding in Honduras. I'm a desperate man. Send lawyers, guns, and money. This shit has hit the fan.
Hi folks, Bob Main here. Welcome to another episode of the Handgun World Show. Episode number 96 to be exact. Once again, recording this in advance from my home office. Don't have to travel. And, you know, because I'm starting a new job here pretty soon, I've done a lot of these in advance. I'm just posting them whenever I feel like posting them. So, I want to thanks for tuning in. This is a practical show. I don't get real technical. Most of you know I don't talk about, you know, tricking out AR-15s and stuff like that. I don't know that kind of stuff. I'm just an everyday, ordinary guy just talking about one of my passions and hobbies, which is shooting sports, concealed carry, and general self-defense. So in this show, the subject matter is going to be primarily about the draw stroke, when you're carrying your pistol, when you're out there, out and about. And folks, whether you're a civilian, whether you're military personnel, or whether you're law enforcement personnel, I don't think it really matters, actually. Having an effective draw is so important. If you go back to the last episode to the show notes and watch that video that was on Front Sight's website, that officer did a great job of drawing his gun and deploying it quickly. So we're going to talk about draw stroke and also going to talk about performing reloads. And I've got one of my favorite shooting buddies on the line here waiting to get on. Actually, this was pre-recorded in advance, but he's going to be played here in just a minute. Steve Zofi, once again. Now, this is going to be the last one we're going to do for a while, folks, the last interview. The next time you're going to hear from him is for those of you that invest in my CD. We're going to talk about creative shooting from Brian Enos's book. This episode is going to be more geared towards self-defense than competition shooting, I would say. Recently, we've talked a lot about competition. My show is a mixture of competition and self-defense. So in this, we talk about properly drawing your gun, effective, efficient use of motion when drawing your gun, and also some things about reloads, performing reloads. I was wrong about some of the efficient ways to do a reload. And Steve kind of does a pretty good job here of setting me straight and giving me some good advice. So I think you'll appreciate that as well. I'll turn on that interview in just a minute. So let me take care of a little bit of listener feedback and a few announcements, because I'm not going to come back on after the interview. The end of the interview is going to be the end of the show. First of all, let's cover some listener feedback. Andy sent me a real good email about revolvers. He said he still hasn't quite got caught up on all of my podcasts, but he's got a couple cents worth that he wants to put in, and it's pretty good here. He says he has a Smith & Wesson 38 Special Airweight, and he calls it his anti-carjacking gun. Or at least to protect himself from someone who comes up to his car and wants to do him harm. He keeps it in the center console of his vehicle so that he can get to it in seconds. He says it's easier than trying to grab his Glock 19 out of the holster with his seatbelt on. He says, if I need to use the revolver, it'll be at point-blank range or perhaps 10 feet or so. I know it won't jam. And this is a very big plus in my book. And he's got it loaded with Winchester Supreme PDX-1. Hollow points. And he went on to say that it does kind of hurt to practice with that gun, and sometimes those small revolvers can do that. It can hurt if you're shooting a lot of rounds with them. But Andy, thanks for sending that in. You know, I never thought of that. That's probably a pretty good use for a revolver, just something to keep in your vehicle for this kind of specific niche, an anti-carjacking gun. Now, you guys have heard me say many times, I do that with my Glock 19. You know, what I do, this is my mode of carry in a vehicle. My mode is, you know, the Glock is going to be on my belt. It's going to be appendix inside the waistband in one of my AIWB holsters, or it's going to be at about 330 in my CompTac MTAC. When I get in the vehicle, after I sit down and after I put my seatbelt on, I very carefully finger off the trigger, take my gun out of my holster, and I have a little cheap nylon holster that I bought at a gun show. and I've got it between the console and the passenger seat. And I slide that into the nylon holster. I slide my Glock into the nylon holster, and I put a baseball cap over it. Now, I don't leave it that way. I don't leave my vehicle unattended that way. That's a no-no. Don't do that. But while I'm driving, the baseball cap is over my gun. So, it's concealed. Okay, according to the letter of the law, it's concealed. You cannot see it. You cannot see the pistol. All I have to do is just flip that baseball cap off, and the butt of my gun is sticking up above the seat. All I got to do is just grab the Glock 19 and go to work and make sure that I don't sweep myself, like my arm or my wrist or my hand or whatever, if I have to use it in self-defense. So it's my anti-carjacking gun. And then what happens is when I get to my destination, I very carefully finger off of the trigger. I put the gun back in my holster. That's why I think it's important to have a holster that makes it real easy to reholster your gun. This is one of the reasons why I've moved away from soft leather holsters, because the mouths of the holsters don't stay open, and it's way too hard when I'm getting in and out of the vehicle and doing as much driving as I'm doing. And I got a different car now, folks, because I have a different job. So now I'm down to a Honda Accord. I used to have a Ford SUV that was had a little bit more room. Now I'm down to a Honda Accord. So in a little bit tighter spaces, I have to be real careful. But I want a holster with a mouth that's going to stay open, because that makes it a lot easier to reholster the gun. Think about that. When you're getting in and out of cars a lot or in and out of vehicles a lot, think about that. So, Andy, thanks for sending in that email. I very much appreciate that, and thank you for being a loyal listener to my show. That's it. That's just one email since the last podcast that I wanted to cover. And keep the comments coming, folks. I appreciate that. On the Gun Rights Radio Network forum, you can always get on there and chime in about my shows and so forth. Good people on that forum. And don't forget about my YouTube channel, my Facebook page by the name of Handgun World on Facebook, Shooters Legion, another good networking site that I'm on that for shooters only. It's pretty good. And, of course, don't forget about my CD coming up on December the 15th. Get your copy, $15. Go to handgunworld.com. That's it, folks. Have a good rest of the week. By the time you hear this show, I'm going to be in the gun-unfriendly state of New York with some doing some product training up there in upstate New York for the new company that I'm working for. So it's a gun-unfriendly state. We'll just have to see how it goes. It's going to be interesting. And since the great Republic of New York does not accept my Texas concealed carry license, I guess the pistols are going to have to stay home while I'm in New York for a couple days. I don't like that idea, but I guess sometimes I can't avoid it. See, I typically take my guns with me, at least a gun with me when I fly, but again, a lot of it depends on the destination. And this is a gun-unfriendly destination that I'm going to. So you guys have a good rest of the week. The next show is going to be probably a week from today. And after I get back from New York, the next day on Saturday, I'm going to go shoot an IDPA match, so I may have an update for you on what happened over there at IDPA. So once again, thanks for tuning in to episode number 96. Don't go away, folks. Here's a brief commercial for the Gun Rights Radio Network and gunfacts.info. And then right after this commercial, Steve Zofie and I again talking about the draw stroke and reloads. Have a good one.
Whenever you see big city mayors campaigning for gun control, rows of uneasy-looking police officers are forced to stand behind the mayors. The reason our police friends are uneasy is they don't buy into the mayor's political scam. The president of the Black Police Caucus said his members believe there should be no gun rationing, and nearly 100% of their membership thinks criminals are able to obtain guns through illegal means. Likewise, 94% of the National Association of the Chiefs of Police believe that citizens should be able to purchase firearms for self-defense and sporting purposes. Maybe this is why billionaire New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg called the 32,000-member Fraternal Order of Police a fringe group, because unlike Michael, cops know who the good guys are, namely you, not Bloomberg. Arm yourself with facts to strip the gun control industry bare. Visit gunfacts.info and get your free copy of Gun Facts. Called Indispensable by Cam Edwards of NRA News, Gun Facts is your rapid reference guide to debunking gun control myths and shaming politicians into obedience. www.gunfacts.info.
All right, Steve Zofie's back with me. Now, Steve, you know, our last conversation, we sort of left the subject of performing a reload, and I kind of cut it off right there. And I know you want to talk about the proper draw and everything, but you had some good things to say about performing a reload and either looking at the target or not looking at the target and looking the magazine into the magwell and things like that. And you kind of got me rethinking it. So why don't you pick up where you left off on that, and then we'll get into draw and everything.
Okay, sure. So the point there about reloads, and you had mentioned before that in terms of your reload process that you wanted to basically keep your focus on the target or the threat downrange and to basically work at grooving the reload to the point that you don't really need to look at the magwell as you insert the magazine into the gun.
Right.
I would probably differ in that opinion. What I do in terms of a reload, and I think I can kind of like cater to both you know, desires of looking the magazine into the gun, but also being aware of what's happening downrange. In terms of when I do a reload, again, it's all of economy of motion. So what you want to do is to minimize excessive movement, and I think the economy of motion thing probably pretty much applies to everything that we do in competitive shooting. So we're going to minimize excessive motion or wasted motion. In terms of reload, what I do is I from the point that I'm done firing that last round,
right,
I immediately hit the magazine release button, and this is with the gun relatively vertical. And the reason that is being is that obviously I wanted to use gravity to my, you know, fullest benefit so that the magazine drops straight out of the gun. If you turn the gun sideways, hit the mag release, all of a sudden the magazine is, you know, relatively horizontal in the gun and it does not want to come out as easily as if you hold it vertical.
Sure.
So at that point, we're going to hit the mag release, the gun is vertical. You simply fold your arm back and keep the gun high, and you're literally bringing it back toward your face pretty much in the same line of sight that you have toward the target.
Maybe a little bit lower or pretty much the same line of sight?
Pretty much the same. In fact, what I do is that when I bring it back, the trigger guard is almost in line with the target. So my barrel is actually slightly higher than my line of sight.
Yeah.
And the magazine well is slightly lower than my line of sight, and straight through is where my trigger guard is.
Yeah, I follow.
So at that point there, when I bring it back, and I bring it back, I'm just trying to figure it out here, probably about maybe 8 inches or so. You don't want to bring it back so far to, you know, to your face that you have to go a long ways back out to the target, because, again, we're trying to minimize economy of motion here. If we bring the gun all the way back, we've got to push it all the way back out to the target. On the other hand, if you leave it all the way out, you know, in your firing position, you don't have a lot of control over getting the magazine into the gun. So there's a kind of like a happy, you know, mid-ground point there that we want to bring the gun back to.
Yeah, yeah.
So we bring it back to that point, and at that point there, you want to look at the magazine well of the gun. Your hand, okay, at this point has already, and literally as soon as you, you are dumping that magazine, your weak hand is going to the mag, to your fresh magazine. At that point, you're ready to insert the magazine into the gun. You're looking at the mag well. Your index finger of your weak hand, if I say left hand here, it's because I'm a right-handed shooter, so if I start talking left hand, right hand, or whatever, for anybody
right,
else's benefit, if you're left-handed, just reverse that. So the index finger of my left hand is right up the front spine, if you want to call it that, of the magazine. The bullets mm-hmm. are all pointing forward. My finger, the tip of my index finger of my left hand, is more than likely probably touching or very close to touching the bullet in the magazine.
Yeah, so you can kind of feel where the where the bullets are in it, so you can guide them into the magwell better, right?
Right, exactly. Exactly. It's really just an indexing thing onto the magazine.
Yeah.
And the idea here is that your finger is literally straight up the front of the magazine, and it's the finger into the hole thing. Okay, so everybody knows how to basically, you know, wherever you point or point your finger or whatever, it's a very easy thing to do. So you are literally pointing your finger up the magazine well of the gun to insert the magazine. Now, the key thing here is not leaving your finger there rigid and tight, because it is possible, and I've heard this happening, infrequent as it is, but if you leave your finger there and jam it hard, you can break your finger if you jam it into the magazine well of the gun. So you literally So as you start inserting the magazine, you literally start folding your hand, your index finger away, and using the heel of your left hand, pushing the magazine up into the gun. As soon as you have confirmed that you have got the magazine up in the gun, your vision now goes back out to the target. Okay.
Okay. So now it's just really a quick glance at the magwell and then back to the target.
It's enough of a look at the magwell
yeah.
up to the point that you confirm that you've got your magazine into the magwell of the gun. As soon as you confirm that, you're back out to the target.
Okay.
And it does not take very much time. The beauty of this is that I'm going to use the term like a vision box or awareness box or whatever, is that while you are doing this, you are able to look at the gun and at the same time peripherally see kind of downrange and what's happening there. Again, this is the benefits of, or the side benefit of economy of motion, is that not only are you keeping the gun in the best place so that you're not wasting excessive motion here, but you're also keeping it in the best position so that you're able to kind of see everything as it's happening at the same time.
Right, right.
Now, I will admit that in the past, I have done the no-look reload.
I've done it too.
Yeah, I mean, and typically it's just, you know, the you're looking at the target, it's so close right there in front of you that you
yeah.
can get it done. But the reason I can probably pull off the no-look reload is that I practice reloads, you know, maybe tens of, you know, maybe 100,000s of times doing that, and it's all just, you know, I'm not going to use the term muscle memory because we don't have that, but just mechanics.
Yeah, and let me just remind people that this is, you know, you can do that at home. You can practice that at home. You don't have to be out at the range to do that.
Exactly, and I would highly recommend it, and that's one of the things that I think a lot of, you know, new shooters do is that, you know, they go to the range and they take their gun, they take their ammo, they pay their, you know, $10 or whatever it costs to go run a range fee right now. They throw the target out there at 15 yards.
Right.
And they shoot, but they never practice doing reloads because ranges typically don't allow you to practice doing speed reloads.
That's right.
So it's not something that they've really ever done. So what I would recommend doing is that, you know, you can practice reloads at home all you want. You don't need live ammunition. In fact, you don't want live ammunition, obviously, when we're doing dry fire.
No, of course you don't.
You can do this grooving technique of you know, just doing reloads over and over and over and over and hammering that technique home, doing dry fire. And again, like we were discussing before, is that you're not distracted by, you know, muzzle flash, bang, or anything else while you're doing this.
Right. Yep. Did I lose you, Steve?
Nope, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
No problem. So I think that's the key thing there on doing reloads is to, you know, to look at the magazine well as you do it. The other thing to keep in mind is that very often when we're doing a reload, we're not doing a static reload. Typically, it's either, you know, you're reloading on the move, or you know, at least trying to get from point A to point B or whatever. It's very
especially on the move, yeah.
Right. It's very infrequent that you end up doing a static reload anywhere, unless the course of fire dictates it. Probably.
Well, unless and of course, you know, I suppose in real life, some people may say if you're behind cover or concealment, you may do it static. But you know, when I think about that, I mean, you know, I'm gonna want to move. I'm not gonna want to just stand there and be a target.
If you can move, you should
move.
If
you can,
right?
Yeah. If you have the room to move, yeah.
And this gets into, we talked about economy of motion. There's also economy of time. And the idea there is that if you can do two things at once, do it. So
yeah.
The idea is that if you have to go from point A to point B and you have to reload at some point, we're just going to say that it's a given that you have to reload at this point, that your guns run dry or whatever the case may be.
Right.
It would be in your best interest to do the reload while you're moving from point A to point B, rather than standing at point A, doing the reload, and then going to point B.
And don't you think that would apply to any situation, not just USPSA or IDPA?
Yeah, this is true of anything.
This is
not competition. This is just common sense that,
yeah,
you know, that you want, if you can do two things at once, it's in your best interest to do the two things at once. Now, there are some exceptions to that. And that's something that you kind of need to play around with, experimentation.
Exactly.
Before we were talking about the use of a shot timer, this is a perfect example for that, that you go to the range, and let's say you set up two shooting boxes, a box to the left, a box to the right. And your two techniques are, do I want to do a really fast reload in box A and then run fast to box B, or do I want to do kind of a, you know, a reload on the way from box A to box B? this is stuff that you need to really experiment with and find out what works best for you. And that's where a shot timer really comes in handy, because you can really quantify or test these, you know, these two scenarios out.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of people, whenever you do a reload, it's kind of like the danger factor. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of room for things to go wrong when doing a reload. It's like, you know, you missed the mag well.
Yeah, there's so much of a room for error.
Right, right. So the idea is to minimize the error, the disaster factor, which may happen.
I mean, I've done everything. I've dropped magazines. I've, you know, reached for them with my weak hand and accidentally knocked them out of my magazine mm-hmm. pouch.
Right.
I've done that. Let's see. What else have I done? I've missed the mag well. I've failed to fully seat the mag once before. Actually, I've done that more than once.
Mm-hmm.
Failed to fully seat the mag. And, yeah, there's so many things that can go wrong in that.
So sometimes there, what you want to do is it may be in your best benefit, and again, it just gets down to what you need to really find out for yourself what works best for you. But a lot of times we refer to as the one-step reload, which literally means that, you know, if you're moving from box A to box B, that you can get that reload done in one step. I mean, as soon as you're taking your first step out of the box, you get the reload done, and now that it's done, you can move very fast too. Box B or whatever it is you're going.
Okay, I just learned something there. I just learned what the one-step reload is. Okay.
Okay, yeah, it's the infamous one-step reload is basically you're getting your reload done in one step.
Okay.
And a lot of times it is, I mean, I typically actually end up doing a one-step reload if it's just a wide open, you know, move from box A to box B. If there's an obstacle in the way or something else that I've got to manipulate or maneuver myself around, I may elect to do it at a different location or whatever.
Yeah.
But at any rate, if you're literally walking and trying to get the magazine into the gun, you know, as you're walking and stepping, you're bouncing, and every time you bounce or step or whatever, your hands are moving and everything, and you may end up missing the mag well in the gun. So that's why a lot of times the one-step reload, get it done, and then run as fast as you possibly can, if the course of fire allows that, or just, you know, general allows that or whatever. Is your best, you know, best plan.
Good, good. All right. Well, thanks for recapping reload. Now let's get into something that is going to be a lot of fun. I'm interested to hear what you have to say. On page 50, Brian talks a lot about draw, and I honestly have not had a chance to read in detail everything he says here about draw. I have to be honest about that. But tell us what, you know, because I think this is important. Did you happen to watch that video that I posted in the show notes of the last show?
It was, this was on the police officer.
Yeah, did you see that one?
I saw it, but the video, to me, I to be honest, I was watching it on my computer at work.
Yeah.
Hello.
that's okay.
My employer's not working, listening. No, but at any rate, so I wasn't able to watch it in a very large format, and it was fairly grainy to begin with, but it looked like the police officer literally got run over. But did he end up shooting the guy?
Yeah, by the way, I'm going to call your boss and tell him you're watching shooting videos.
Yeah, okay.
it was really good. I was very, very impressed with it. You just have to see it. You have to see how quick it was. And, a guy pulled a knife on him and lunged at the officer, lunged at him with a knife. And they even put a warning on that video saying it might not be for everybody to see, but you got to see it. And I thought, you know, there's the importance of draw. And I put that on the forum, and the post was, this is why you train from the holster.
Right, right. And I think that is a really, you know, something I observed is that a lot of people have not practiced doing a draw. I think a lot of people look at a holster as just some place to put their gun when they're not shooting.
Exactly.
And never actually work in a draw. And it becomes really evident when you actually start looking at new shooters or people who haven't done this practice of now trying to actually do a draw and just seeing all the problems that they run into.
Okay, well, let me ask you a quick question. Do you look at it as a three-step draw or a five-step draw?
Five-step draw.
Five-step? Why don't you explain those real quick?
Okay, so five-step draw. Well, I'm going to literally take you right from the very beginning to right to the very end and some of the points that that I like to make in between.
Good, good.
So step one is going to the gun. So whether we're starting from a hands down or a hands in surrender position, hands in surrender is just wrists above your shoulders, mm-hmm. or what's sometimes called the interview position where your hands are kind of out in front of you, first step is your strong hand goes to the gun, your weak hand goes to basically your belt buckle or somewhere in there, and it stays there. Okay, so that's the first step. That's step number one. Step number two is actually drawing the gun out of the holster. There are three ways that I know of getting the gun out of the holster. One is the where you kind of you bring your hand up through the gun and draw it out of the holster. And that is very risky because if you don't get a good firm grip on the gun, the next thing you're going to find is you're probably going to end up throwing the gun downrange. It's a very fast draw.
I've come close to doing that.
Okay. It's a very fast draw, but it's a very dangerous draw.
Uh-huh.
The other draw technique is coming down from the top and literally jamming your hand into the gun. But to do that, you're driving the gun basically in the wrong direction. You're driving it back into the holster, or your momentum's going downward rather than coming upward. Mm-hmm. So that, in my mind, is a slow draw. The draw that I do and like that I like to recommend is you come in from the side. So what I do is I have my it's almost like a pre-positioned grip that I would actually grab the gun with. My three fingers in my right hand are curled, literally ready to come around the front strap of the gun.
Okay.
My trigger finger is now in straight forward, so it comes down the side of the gun.
Right.
And my thumb is actually up extended, so my thumb and index finger shape an L. And the reason for that is that I'm literally going to put the web of my hand there right into the back strap of the gun, coming in from the side, and then lift the gun or snatch the gun or pop the gun or whatever you want to call it out of the holster.
Okay, let me stop you there for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
This is good, and I think the reason why this is good for people to practice is because you're going to revert to this type of training if you need to. And I think this applies not just to IDPA or IPSC when you can anticipate a buzzer, but any time that you have to do that, you're going to revert to that training. Would you agree?
Definitely. And what we're just talking about here does not apply. I mean, I shouldn't say this is not competition that we're talking about. I mean, however, I'm talking about this from a competition standpoint, but this is any type of draw that you do. Anybody who's out drawing a gun, this applies to basically the proper draw that we're going to, you know, try to talk about here.
Okay.
Okay, so the next thing that is very key is that when you get your hand on the gun, it is very important that you get a full and complete and final full firing grip on the gun, because you cannot fix a bad grip on the way to the target.
Oh, good point. Good point.
Yeah, it is very important that you get your final grip the first time on the gun. If you have a fumbled grip, there's really no way to easily fix it. You can kind of, you know, if you do get end up with a bad grip, you can kind of jostle the gun around in your hand, but at this point, all of a sudden now, we don't have a really good solid grip on the gun while you're doing that, and you may end up dropping it. So it is very important that you get a full and complete firing grip on the gun while it's in the holster, not when it's out of the holster, but when it's in the holster, and then draw the gun.
That's a good point.
Okay, so that's step two. Step three is very simple. It's just literally rotating the gun toward the target. So what happens there is that your forearm now, and your elbow, let me just talk here first, your elbow goes down and your forearm is now parallel to the ground. That's step three. It's just the rotation point.
Okay.
For
I'm
me, it's kind of,
okay.
So literally, you know, if you're doing the draw, your hand, your arm, your elbow is kind of up,
mm-hmm.
your shoulder's kind of forward,
mm-hmm.
your hand's on the gun. At this point here, we just literally drop your elbow down, your forearm goes flat, and the gun now is pointed straight at the target.
Yeah, now let me remind everybody, what we're talking about here is drawing from about the 3:30 position.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Not 1 o'clock or 1:30 AIWB.
Well, I think it actually applies there, because I, in my competition holster, my limited gun, I probably hold it probably about, I'm trying to figure out here, it's that hip bone point or whatever it is, so it's like 2 o'clock, 2:30,
okay.
Somewhere in there.
Okay.
So it really applies there. If you're coming from a 3:30 position, you know, your arm, your shoulder is really much more farther forward, but you draw the gun up, you're kind of hunching your shoulder up, but again, you literally drop your elbow down and your forearm comes flat or parallel to the ground.
Yeah, that's right.
The gun is pointed at the target.
That's right, yeah.
The beauty of that also is that, and you talked about this before, in a defensive shooting situation, where we're literally talking contact distance, and you can't extend toward the target, you are in a position. Okay, so at this point, your forearm is flat, and you're in a fully position right now that if you were in contact distance to a target, that you can go ahead and fire at this point.
Okay.
Okay, so that's step three. Step four is what's typically called the smack and click stage. Now, what's happening here is that you are now, at this point, bringing your weak hand up to the strong hand and driving the gun forward. And at this point, your hands are coming together, and this is where it seems like for a lot of people that things start horribly going wrong.
It's where it goes wrong for me. That's when I'm driving it towards the target, that's where it starts to go wrong for me.
That's what I've seen.
Yeah, that's where, you know, I get everything up to this point correct, and then this is where, you know, everything starts to break down for me.
Steps 1 through 3, typically you can take anybody, and they'll get 1 through 3 down no problem whatsoever.
Exactly.
It's step 4 and step 5 where things kind of go south.
Yeah, I agree.
So I like to use what's called a pinch and roll technique at step 4. When your weak hand is coming into the gun, the index finger of your weak hand comes up and hits the bottom of the trigger guard, kind of as sort of like a knife blade angle, coming in, let's say, 45 degrees. And as you continue pushing forward, you literally roll your hand into the gun as it's driving forward, and it kind of, to a certain degree, pinches the skin on your index finger there into the trigger guard of the gun.
Okay.
So step 4 here, again, is just simply bringing the support hand up to the gun and coming up into what we're going to call our normal thumbs forward, you know, IPSC-type grip onto the gun.
Okay.
So step 4 to step 5 is then driving the gun into the target and then breaking the shot. Here's what I've seen happen between step 3 and step 5, and we talked about this before, but there's what's referred to as the porpoise.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that.
Okay, so you have the porpoise draw stroke and the bowling ball draw stroke.
That sounds funny, but go ahead, keep going.
Okay, so the porpoise presentation is, and we're going to use a line of, just so you know, your line of sight is now looking at the target.
Yeah.
So when the hands come together, the gun goes up over the line of sight, under the line of sight, back over the line of sight, and back into the line of sight. So it's doing an over, under, kind of like an S pattern, like a porpoise breaking the water or the surface of
That's why it's called that. Now, I've done that. Boy, I tell you, it's like, you know, I can't get this front sight to settle down here, you know?
Well, I don't know where it comes from, and I'm suspicious that it may actually come from some of the early programs or movies or whatever you would see, that when people would do this draw, that they come with like this really over-exaggerated over and under, or, you know.
That's probably true.
Kind of like, I'm showing you the gun, and here's what it looks like, and now I'm really pointing it at you. I mean, I don't know where it comes from, but I've seen it a lot in that. That's one of the common draw strokes that I end up seeing in a lot of people who have not done a lot of drawing or that work. The other approach is bowling ball, and what happens there is that people will get the hands together, but they get it down in kind of like a low ready position. So
right.
The gun is pointed at probably, you know, 45 degrees to the angle. I'm sorry, 45 degrees to the ground. And then they just bring, with the arms extended, just bring the gun up and just plop it right into the line of sight. And
okay. You know, now that I hear you describe this, I can picture everybody, including me, doing one of these two at some time or another, or sometimes doing it one way and the next time doing it the bowling ball style.
Mm-hmm. And the bowling ball style gets its name because of the fact that the whole entire arm motion thing is kind of as if you were there, you know, throwing a bowling ball. Your arm, your strong hand
yeah.
arm just literally comes up in a big arc,
yeah.
comes up straight, and there it is. So the proper way to do it is it's kind of like a diagonal, actually. It's as you are bringing the gun up and your hands go together, and again, the gun is pretty much right out here, I would say at chest level, because that's where your weak hand was starting, at your belly or at your belt buckle. The gun has come out in front of you. Your weak hand comes up. It's really at chest level. You're looking at the target. You start bringing the gun up. And what happens is that the gun comes up, intersects your line of sight, and drives forward probably about 4 or 5 inches into the target. What this does is that it allows your eyes to actually start seeing the sight and picking it up. As you are driving it forward, and since you are looking at the target, You're literally driving the front sight into the target, and it's a very fast way to do the draw. It's also a very clean way, or you know, lack of wasted motion or anything like that. But it allows you to pick up the target and pick up the front sight a lot faster than anything else.
Okay.
And that's it. That's steps 1 through 5. That's all there is to a draw.
Well, thanks for describing that, because a lot of people have asked me that question, and I just really didn't even know how to explain that. So that was good.
And the beauty of this is that you can work in this in dry fire practice and try to eliminate any of this wasted motion and just groove this same pattern over and over and over. But the problems that I've seen are typically from step 3 to step 5, where you're either step 4, where your hands are coming together, mm-hmm. Or after your hands come together, of what happens from that point to the target, where you'll see a lot of wasted motion.
Now, is that what you – now, to build speed, to make it fast, is it your opinion that it just comes from practicing
repetition.
It thousands and thousands of times?
Yeah, just repetition. You just keep on working this over and over. And the key thing here is to not try to force speed, but just try to force smooth, because, you know, smooth is fast. If you eliminate wasted motion,
exactly.
it's very quick to the target. And don't try to exaggerate any of this stuff. And what I like to also do – I forgot to mention this, but I like to, when I'm actually trying to teach somebody who is new to doing draw, is I actually like to do what I call reverse draw. And what I do there is I start at the 5 o'clock position, so the gun is on the target, and I have them bring the gun back to 4 o'clock, where the hands come together. So they just go from that point there and rock it back out to 5.
You mean have them go from number 5 to number 4?
From number 5 to number 4, back
okay.
to number 5 to 4, 5 to 4, 5 to
okay.
4. And what they're doing there is grooving that whole entire thing of rotating the gun up into your line of sight and actually seeing the front sight come onto the target. So I have them groove 5 to 4, 5 to 4, 5 to 4. Then after I get that down, then we come 4 to 3. So all 4 to 3 is that bringing the gun back, breaking your hands away from the gun, bringing it forward, bringing your hands together, and literally doing the pinch and roll, pinch and roll, pinch and roll from 4 to 3 over and over and over.
Okay,
so you
that's
do
good
that.
Too.
Then you go 5 to 3, so you're literally going all the way from on the target back to your chest, break your hands, and come back out and do the same thing again. So you're from number 5, you bring the gun back, you break your support hand away from the gun, and then with the gun pretty much at, you know, your chest position, where your support hand is not touching your strong hand, but off to the left of your strong hand,
mm-hmm.
and you drive forward and start doing that. And that's, again, like I was saying, is that the problems that I've seen happen between 3 and 5, and it's for some reason that if we eliminate the whole entire 1, 2, and 3, which is the go to the gun, draw to the gun, bring the gun up,
yeah.
part of the draw stroke, and just work on where the trouble areas are, which are steps 4 to 5, or I should say 3 to 5, and just have them groove that, I think you'll end up with a much faster, better draw in a shorter period of time of just focusing on where the trouble areas are. Because like you said, and what I've seen, people get 1 to 3 down okay, but it's everything after that that usually goes sideways.
Yeah, so practicing it backwards makes sense.
It does. It really
does. Because you burn that into your memory.
Right, and it's something, actually, I think it was Matt Briquette who I learned that from in one of his instructional videos, and it really, I thought, wow, that's interesting, and have actually done it with some newer shooters, and it really does work.
That's good. That's good. You know what? As a matter of fact, you know, you've done such a good job with this, breaking down the draw and the reload, that pretty much covers the second chapter. I think that's a good stopping point right there.
I think that's pretty much everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, those are, and like I said, I've been, you know, people have requested that so much about, you know, reloads and draw, and it's because that's probably because it's probably what people struggle with the most. I know I do.
Well, it's a thing they don't practice, and then the same
exactly.
thing. I mean, when I first started out, I never practiced doing draw and reload at all. I mean, my hobby was shooting, and I went to the range and I went and shot, but
yeah.
I never did any work on practice doing reloads and drawing. And it wasn't until I started becoming involved with competition shooting that all of a sudden that now was a focus of my practice.
I've blown so many stages. I've blown so many stages during reload. It's not even funny.
And it's interesting that if you ask a lot of people what they do, what's dry fire, what does dry fire mean to you, and a lot of them will talk about doing draws and reloads.
Say that again?
I was just going to say that if you ask a lot of people, you know, what do you do when you do, you know, dry fire practice, and I bet anything you will hear a lot of them will say, or at least include as part of their dry fire practice, will be doing draws and reloads.
Yeah, they should be.
And
they
that's the majority of what I do. I mean, I've talked about this before, but my dry fire practice is limited as it is. Ends up being draw, reloads, and target transition and target acquisition.
Yeah, I think we talked about that before.
Right.
And I was shocked by how much that you practice that. But that's good because, you know, if those are the biggest time wasters or time killers, that's the best thing to practice on.
Well, and also from the standpoint, if you look at a course of fire, what do? Okay, so you draw.
Right.
You run around. You shoot a target. You transition to targets. And you reload. So you might as well But on the other hand, and we talked about this during the last episode, is that you also need to practice what you don't like to do. So I also do strong hand, weak hand transitions and stuff like that. So that's another part of my practice.
Yeah, you heard my story about that match that I recapped where I transitioned from weak to strong, and I didn't have a good enough grip on the gun, and so it stovepiped on me.
Right.
And then
right.
I got the chance to clear a malfunction. That was fun.
Yeah. One thing that you mentioned there is kind of funny because, and I remember in one of the IPSC 101 classes that I was helping instruct, we got to the part of the segment of it doing drawing, and one of the guys that was in the classes is like, "Oh my God, this just feels really weird."
Uh-huh.
And my thought was, "Well, wait, if this really feels really weird doing this, wait until we get to the point of doing a reload and transitioning the gun to the weak hand when you do that." That's one of the exercises that we do is we have them shoot freestyle, do a reload, transfer the gun to the weak hand, and then shoot again.
Ooh,
and I mean, you really want to talk about putting it. Yeah, I mean, it is. I guess I would say, no, it's really not that tough. But to somebody who's not done it before, who, first off, they've probably not shot strong hand. They probably definitely have not shot weak hand. They probably never have done a reload before in their life. And all of a sudden, I'm asking them to put it all together.
know. Yeah, and they're saying, "Slow down, Steve. Come on."
Yeah.
Good stuff. Thank you for doing this, and thanks for coming on again. And we'll have to do this. Now, I have to be honest. I haven't done number 3 yet. I haven't read it, and we'll do that, and then we'll put that on the CD.
Right. Sounds good.
Thanks,
and
Steve.
I would probably say that chapter 3 is probably the most fun, if you want to call it that. Probably the most beneficial. I mean, I think personally speaking, I got more out of chapter 3, this entire book, than I got out of anything. Especially when he talks about the site focus types 1 through 5. I mean, that to me was just like a complete eye opener.
And it's called Creative Shooting.
Right.
Yeah, I'm going to probably have to read that 2 or 3 different times to get the gist of it, I'm sure.
As are many of the parts of this book, unfortunately. Yeah.
For me. Thanks for doing this. I appreciate it. Especially thanks for breaking down the reload and the draw like that.
Certainly, yeah. I think it's the one area that I've seen a lot of people have a lot of trouble with.
It helped me because those are my 2 weak points, the reload and the draw. Those are my 2 weak points right there.
Because it's the things that we typically don't practice.
Right? Well, yeah, and I'm guilty of that. Yeah, I would say that's what I typically don't practice.
Right, right.
You know, until I'm out there doing a match and then it's too late.
And unfortunately, during a match, I mean, you know, for each given stage, you have 1 draw and maybe 1 or 2 reloads.
Yeah.
But if you have a bad draw or a really bad reload, I mean, that's seconds that you're adding on to your time, I've seen this before, is that people say, well, how can I go faster? How can I learn to be a faster shooter? And they think that the way to being faster is by shooting faster, trying to shoot the targets faster. That's not where you become a faster shooter. The way you become a faster shooter is by eliminating wasted motion, so learning how to enter and exit shooting positions, learning how to do draws properly, learning how to do reloads properly. That's where you actually end up saving time, learning how to literally snap your vision from one target to the other. That's where you save time, not by learning how to pull the trigger faster.
Now that's a very, very good point, because I think it's most people's tendency to rapid fire and pull that trigger as fast as they can, thinking that's going to make them faster.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you look at somebody, I mean, let's say a really fast shooter shoots, you know, 0.15 splits, and a fairly decent shooter will shoot maybe 0.2 to 0.25 splits. Okay, so that's a best case, a tenth of a second split, or I'm sorry, difference, you know, per target. And without getting too complicated in the math here, the guy who's pulling the trigger really fast may end up saving a half a second, maybe 0.75 seconds over the guy who's not blazingly fast. But one bad blown reload is going to be a lot more than 0.75 seconds, or not getting properly into a shooting position. I mean, if you look at all that stuff,
it's all over
all the rest of it.
Yeah,
that is where you save time, not by trying to just mash the trigger faster than the next guy.
Woo, that's good. I'm glad you said that. That's profound because I'm guilty of not working on those.
Well, everybody has to sit. I mean, everybody thinks that the key to going fast is by shooting faster, but that's not it.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve. I appreciate you doing this.
Sure.
Thanks for your time.
Until next time.
Yeah, until next time. All right, take care.